I'm going to say this, but none of you believe me, that we're at the point where things are going to move a lot quicker. Even in saying that, we had intended to go through the first 11 chapters of Genesis only. We weren't going to do the whole book of Genesis. So, and we're doing that because those are the most, I would say, the most maligned chapters of the Bible. And then we'll move on to something else. So if there's some other book you would like to get into study here together on Tuesdays, please give me your input, and then we'll see how the Lord leads and what we're gonna teach. Okay. All right. So we're in chapter 8 of Genesis. Chapter 8. And we're coming to the time when the flood waters will begin to recede, and God is going to restore his creation. It's not a recreation that takes place, but it certainly is a restoration that God does. Remind you that because of the flood, everything has changed. The environment itself has changed. We joke about global warming, and maybe some people don't joke about it, but I do. So anyways, but the greatest global warming the world's ever seen is what God did. And he changed everything. And remember, we talked about that prior to the flood, there was a canopy. The Bible speaks of a canopy over. That opened up, and also the water from under the ground opened up, which caused a change in the topography of the earth. And we have the seas. We have all these different things that are done. I encourage you to take a look at a world map this week, and how incredibly, if you were to take the different continents, you could bring them together, and you see it fit together like a puzzle. It's kind of amazing. And even today, we don't live on a solid base. Everything's moving today. We have the tectonic plates are moving today. Certainly they're not moving they did after the flood and stuff, but all of that broke up. And that's how the Bible described it. It is the greatest catastrophe the world has ever seen. And yet it's interesting that we in the church, if we're not careful, we turn it into a little kid's story. We're talking about the full judgment of God upon all humanity, guys. And not only on all humanity, but also the animal kingdom and all the different things that are a part of that. So I guess I didn't set up enough chairs and stuff. So I'll have you. You've come earlier next week. All right. So let's go to the 8th chapter and let's look at what begins to happen upon the earth after the flood. Here's what it says. Then God remembered Noah. Now this is. By the way, I just want to throw this out there so you get this verbiage. I know I'll mess up this word because I have trouble with anything more two syllables. So the term is anthropomorphic. And that term simply means in scripture, as you read it, as Moses is writing this, he writes it at a level where he gives human attributes to God. Now, someone said, was he allowed to do that? Well, I guess he is allowed to do it because it's inspired. But the point is not that he's trying to turn God into a human or anything less than fully God, but he is trying to write it in a way that we can receive it. Who could, I mean, if God was just to even to another person, like inspire the word of God to speak for one instant of the full glory of who he is, it would consume us. And so, just think about not just talking about him, but actually seeing him in the fullness of who he is. So sometimes you'll find in scripture that they will give human attributes to God, not to diminish who he is or to bring him down, but to make it in order that we can comprehend. So God did not forget about Noah. That's not what he's saying here. God said, oh, yeah, Noah's out on that boat somewhere on the earth. We got to do something about this. You know, and that's not what he's saying here. It is, again, speaking of God fulfilling his plan for Noah, because basically there's nobody else to remember. They're all gone. But he has promised Noah and is about to promise Noah, what I mean by that, to enter into a covenant with Noah that affects not only him and his family, but will affect humanity for the rest of human history. So we read this, that he remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. Now, just as miraculous as the flood itself is, how the water begins to subside and the land begins to dry up also is an act of God. It's not just merely waiting for, you know, when you're talking about what we talk about, the water above all land masses was so many cubits high above any land mass and stuff. What are you going to do with all that water? Where's it going to go? Well, you can see where a lot of it went. There are, you see them, they're called the oceans. Okay, you see a lot of that. But not only do we see that, but probably underneath us, I don't know what level it is anymore, there used to be this huge aquifer under us. So the land masses do not just set, it's not just a solid mass of land. You got water, and underneath that you got magma, you got all these different kind of things that are under there. And I'm giving you my science right now. So, but it's an amazing thing. You drill down far enough in this dry desert, and you will hit water. I grew up in Chandler, and all we ever drank in Chandler was well water. That means they drilled down and they brought the water up for irrigation and for drinking. It was some of the best water you will ever drink coming up through there. So when I got my wisdom teeth out, I was in San Manuel. The guy looked at my teeth. He goes, "You're either from Chandler or Gilbert." The dentist told me. I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Your teeth are so hard, you grew up on well water." And that's true. Sadly, Chandler now gets the CAP stuff that we get that's been treated and it tastes like, well, I'll just let that stay right there. But anyway, there's a vast aquifer of water underneath the land that we're on and stuff too. It's an incredible thing. And you think about, in our mind, we'd say it's got to be solid all the way to the core, but it's not solid all the way to the core. And it's still moving, and all these kinds of things are happening, but not in the huge sense that we see right here. So when we see the water receding, we have God raising up land, we have God lowering land, we have all these different things happening going on at the same time. My point would be this. God's hand is still upon us, as it was when he brought the judgment, as he began to restore the land and restore the earth again so that life can survive on it and grow and multiply. God's hand is still upon it. And I would say this to people. There are a lot of people that even our churches today that have a deist view of God, even today, that God's really not actively involved in what's going on in the world. He just kind of wound it up and said, "Do the best you can." Well, that's how the deists view God. God just created, he wound it up, and you all do the best you can to make it. Well, clearly the Bible does not teach about a deist God, because we see, even in this, we see God's hand upon creation in judgment, but also in restoration. And when the final judgment comes, the Bible speaks even of restoration here, because it says there will be a new heaven and a new earth, for everything else has passed away. So it won't be the restoration of an existing earth. It'll be a new heaven and a new earth after the time of the great white throne. So here we see this again, that God made the waters recede, and God also made this wind that passed over. Where else in the Bible, a little bit later on, do you see this, maybe this wind of God that causes the land, the wetland, to become dry?
Red Sea.
The Red Sea. It happens one other time. Do you remember one other time that it happens like that? Anybody?
The Jordan River
when they crossed over into Jericho. Once again, God stopped the water, made the water stand up, is what it says. But also the wind blew upon, because remember, when the Israelites walked over, it says they walked over on dry land, both places. I'm telling you, if you just back the water up and immediately walk on it, you're going to be bogged down in the mud. But God God's miraculous in those things. So, verse 2, he goes on to say, and the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped. Again, as we've described before, this is not just merely raining, what we understand as raining for 40 days and 40 nights. It is the heavens pouring out what they had and the deep bringing up what it had. So, but notice what happened. It stops. God stops this process. And the rain from heaven was restrained. So again, prior to this, we know very little in biblical text about an ecosystem that we experience right now. I'm talking about prior to the rains that come in. Remember the little chart you had to do in science class where the water comes up, they build up the clouds, it drops over the land, and then it flows back to the ocean. Everybody remember that little chart? You didn't get to do that chart? That chart was almost as fun as making the volcanoes. You know, and then you pour, what do you pour in a volcano to make it go? Vinegar and baking soda. Smell good too, did it? So, anyway, so he's describing for us here the beginning of an ecosystem. I know we don't like using the term because it sounds like we're new age, but it's the truth that he has set up this ecosystem that works perfectly even after the catastrophe. It's an amazing thing. God is such a creative God, and he's such a God of order and stuff. And by the way, that's exactly what science is. Science is a discipline of studying God's established order. That's what science is. Okay, so to discover that is some people, that's their life, to try to discover those things and stuff. Science is not to create things. It is to observe, make hypotheses, search for facts, and stay with the evidence rather than create evidence. So a lot of what's going on in our day and time, I call pseudoscience. And so and a lot of statements are made as facts today that are simply not facts. So you got to be very careful of some of those things. I've told you before, and I'll say it again, particularly here, biblical Christianity and legitimate science have no problem with one another. They have no problem with one another. That doesn't mean we know everything. I'm just saying they simply do not. Right? So there are some people, I don't know, Christians, say, well, in order to be a scientist, you have to be an atheist. No. I know a lot of scientists that are not atheists. One of them teaches Sunday school every Sunday morning here. One is sitting right back there in the back. So science teachers and scientists their science or their approach, legitimate approach to science, enhances their faith. It does not destroy it. So we see this. It goes on to say, for the waters receded continually from the earth, and that earth there would be what we know as dry land. That term is what that means here. Okay. And again, at the end of 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day, on a mountain in the mountains of Ararat. You know that. Ararat. Okay. What a name. So, by the way, the geographical references here are post-flood references. Everybody get what I just said? Moses wrote this after all this time. So the geographical references are post-flood references. There was not a rare rat before the flood. Everybody got that? Do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that. Okay. These are references and names of places that were established after the flood and were established by the time Moses wrote this. So Moses is looking back and when people understand what the topography of the land is and the geographical references are, he's able to say, you know where the ark rested? Well, you know over in Turkey where Ararat is, that's where it happened. Okay. That's what he's saying there. Okay. So then verse 5, and the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So you see as it recedes and stuff. But again, so it tells you that the ark, it rested while the waters were still around it, which we've seen that with boats and stuff. You Navy guys, you've seen that kind of thing before. Don't run aground type of thing. Still in the water, but you ran aground. So that's what's happened here. And then they continue to recede. And it also makes sense as why he would have landed, or the ark would have landed, at the top of a mountain and not resting in a valley somewhere. So we see again the description of the water that recedes. Now, verse 6. So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Can you imagine? I'm always thinking of this, that first breath of fresh air coming in there and stuff. He'd been there for a long time with those animals and different things and stuff, but that able to experience that first breath of fresh air. It must have been awe-inspiring, but at the same time, just a huge relief too. All the different, it's hard to imagine the emotions that would have run through him. But then again, you think about now you're on the earth has changed. It doesn't look like it looked like when you entered the ark, and there's nobody else there.
And you're on top of the mountain.
And you're on top of the mountain, yeah. Pete.
I just got back to this last few weeks. But did you mention at all where you think the ark was built and took off from?
The question, where was the ark built? The closest thing that I have in the study was what we would call, the Mesopotamia area. But again, the land map, we talked about the landmass or the earth or the topography of the earth is completely different. So again, all references go back to the reference where people after the flood, because I'm not sure that anybody has any kind of direct information about what, first of all, what it looked like prior to the flood, or even the description of like a map where things were. There are those, and I'm in this group that hold that the landmass was one prior to the flood. After the flood, we have the breaking up of the landmass and stuff. That's how, again, how do you have a catastrophe that affects the whole world at one time and destroys everything? It's not just a rain. It's so downplayed. Oh, yeah, there was a flood. You know, like your basement flooded or something. Well, nobody has basements in Arizona, but... but it's hard to dig a basement here. Have you figured that one out yet? Pete, it's there are some references like we're east of Eden and talk about the Tigris and the Euphrates and the Hittite and the other one, but all those again are post flood references. You know, if you ask some of the historians and stuff, the center of the earth at that time of the landmass prior to the flood, they would tell you Jerusalem. And we went there. We saw Adam's skull. Nobody believes me. I didn't believe it when I saw it either. But you go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they got a marker right there that they say this here's the center of the earth. My guide moved it with his foot about 6 inches. He said, "I just moved the center of the earth." But over where the supposed place where Jesus died on Calvary, the mountain inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, they have this depiction underneath with bones, and the bones, they tell you that when Jesus bled, his blood creeped down through the cracks and stuff, and Adam was actually buried in there, and his blood landed on Adam's bones. Okay. I'm just telling you what they're telling you, but I found that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is one of the most creepy places in all the Holy Land. And I would prefer that Calvary be at Gordon's Calvary where the tomb is and stuff, but unfortunately it's probably not. So anyways.
So it would have to be a wooded area for building of the ark?
Well, everything was wooden. Everything was wooden. It was. I believe it was one landmass, and we would see it as this lush garden jungle type thing. again, it answers so many questions. Like, again, we talked about it. Why over in Saudi Arabia, where there's nothing but sand, is there so much oil in it? Well, sand does not produce oil. What produces oil? Pressure, organic material, and stuff like that. So what that tell you about what was once over that land right there? Where'd that sand come from? Did it just kind of blow in? You know, over a weekend or something like that? No, you know, everything changed. And even we talked about even the impact of the Ice Age. Ice Age is a product of the flood. The extinction of the large, instantaneous extinction of the large mammals and reptiles. It's a product of the flood. It's not difficult if you just let the Bible speak, because it's there. You don't have to say, well, they had to live billions of years before man ever was on the face of the earth. No, God tells you the catastrophe that took place. They want to tell you some meteor came out. Remember this thing? A meteor came out and killed all the dinosaurs. And then somehow man kind of crawled out of the primordial ooze, and two amoebas bumped together, and we have humanity. After it goes through the fish stage, then the reptile stage, then the monkey stage, and all of a sudden now we have humanity. Man, you got more faith than I've ever had to believe such as that.
I think if I went to the ark, I think you've been to the ark.
That yes.
It really enhances your faith, because you can see it. They have all these signs here. They got the evolution view, creation view,
yeah.
So many things. And it just, to me, it just really helped increase
my faith. I would encourage anybody that gets, if you get to go to Kentucky and go see the ark, do it. It just really is a good experience and stuff. So anyway, so they built, and it's the size. I don't know if it exactly looks like the ark. I don't know what the ark exactly looked like, but it is the size, and it's an incredible size when you start looking at it. So, all right. So verse 7, then he sent out a raven. This is why raven end up in Edgar Allan Poe's poem. And I'm going to see how many of you know your literature. Okay. You can't trust the raven, is what I'm telling you. All right. So he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro until the water had dried from the earth. The raven was not coming back. He'd had enough of that. So he also sent out for himself a dove to see if the waters had abated and the face from the face of the ground. So we have the dove sent out. Some people even say pigeon. Is what he sent out this time, you know, for the homing pigeon and stuff. Either way, he sent out the kind of a bird that would come back. And so verse 8 says, but the dove found no resting place for the sole of its foot. I didn't even know they had a sole on the foot of a dove, but the bottom of its foot, that's all that needs. No place to rest foot, and return into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her in the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days. Then again, he sent out the dove out of the ark. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And Noah knew that the waters had abated from the earth. Now, that's an interesting thing. You just had a flood on the whole earth, and now you have a little olive leaf. It's proof positive you can't kill an olive tree. if you've ever had one, you can't kill them. We've cut them. We've put the poison in them. We've done all the things. And before you know it, here comes more things up. It's pretty interesting. This certainly would be off of I would suppose a small plant. And stuff, which would again would tell them how it had begun to recede. By the way, once again, going to Israel, you can see over 2,000 year old olive trees over there. Pretty incredible. They lived that long. So they're in the Garden of Gethsemane. They're still there. So, all right. So the dove came back, and verse 12 says, so he waited yet another 7 days, sent out the dove, which did not return to him anymore. So what he figured was, what wisely was, he came back. There was still water on the face of the ground. This time when he went, the dove found a place to rest and to live. So he knew it was time. He knew it was time. Now, you cannot, I'm just going to throw this out there again so you get, you cannot take out of this whole narrative the supernatural work of God. You just cannot. In the drying of the land, in the recession of the water, in being able to go out of the ark onto dry land as quickly as it's described here. Again, whatever wind God sent, it was for the purpose of him to dry the land so that the people could move out of the ark. Everybody understand that? Please don't take God out of this. If you do, again, you'll fall into the camp of the skeptics. You can't. There's no way land could dry that quickly. There's no way. It's all these no ways that they're going to tell you unless you know that God's hand. And it says here, he sent the wind. In other words, God dried the land. And Moses described it as God sending a wind upon the land. Ken?
Why didn't he just go on deck and look? Rather, he sent birds out.
Can you imagine, again, what the water would have looked like all around them? Yeah. And by the way, we don't know that he had a deck. He had a window. All it says he had a window, and we know he had a side door that the animals came in. That's the only two openings in the ark that we knew of. So whether he had a deck like the guy in the movie Noah, that movie cracks me up. You know, but anyways, with Russell Crowe and the giant rock mount monsters. So, okay. If you haven't seen it, I'm telling you, that's how they, and they had this guy in this little boat that was trying to sell things to guys on the ark after the flood. He comes scooting up to the side of the ark and sees if they want to buy something. I'm telling you.
Hey, the reason the phone didn't come back is because he had all these bodies
I'm not sure. I guess it could be, but we also talked about a lot of sediment and stuff that everything was changed around. But there certainly could have been. Certainly could have been. It's just, the raven is a scavenger in that sense. So, okay. But I think one of the things that we as Bible believers have to do without assaulting proper science is we have to acknowledge, and I think science people have to acknowledge it. There were things that happened here that would never happen again. It would never happen again. By the way, part of the promise of God was to say it would never happen again. So both in the judgment of God, where he poured out the full wrath upon earth at that time, never happen again in this way, but also in the restoration. You can't mimic something that is supernatural. There's an element you can't. That's why science does not deal with miracles. Because by definition, they're a supernatural act of God that cannot be reproduced. If you can reproduce it, it's natural. If you cannot reproduce it, it's supernatural. And a miracle is not natural. It's supernatural. So the discipline of science does not even deal with miracles. But when a scientist tells you there's no such thing as a miracle, well, first of all, he stepped outside his realm. Everybody get what I'm saying? He may say, I don't believe in miracles because I cannot prove them. Well, there's a lot of things they can't prove that they believe in. Like just the human soul or human life. They can't tell you anything about beyond the biological. They can't tell you anything about that. And yet we all can. Evidence tells us that there's so much more going on in a human life than the biological. Okay. So verse 14, and in the seventh month on the 27th day, the earth was dry. So again, that's pretty quick. For what happened, again, God has to be in there. Then God said to Noah, go out of the ark, you and your wife, and your sons and your wives with you. So notice here, even Noah did not leave the ark until God allowed him to leave the ark. Now, if you've just seen the whole world destroyed, and you weren't destroyed because you were obedient to God, then you're quite likely not going to do anything else till you know God says so. Right? Well, Noah was obedient to God prior to it, so why would we assume that he's not going to be obedient to this time? He was not allowed to leave the ark until God says you can leave the ark. And God has told him now, and not only him, but his family, that they can. It's time for them to leave the ark. And think about what's about to happen. They are about to reestablish humanity. Pretty incredible. Again, the world had to be, except for God being there with them, had to be a very lonely place for a long time. For a long time. And what's out there? What buildings are out there? What, you know, what do you recognize?
Nothing.
You know, that's right. You know, it's like you go into Midwest or something. They say, "Where's so and so?" Well, you go down a little a piece, and go yonder, and all these kinds of things. And especially those people up there toward the north.
Might, no, he didn't go there.
You never heard yonder?
Yeah, but it's beautiful.
Oh, it's
yonder. Is beautiful.
Okay. Okay. So, I believe you. I've driven through there. It is. So. Just imagine the emotions that are happening here. They've trusted God. That's true, but you still have to, I mean, still a human being. So the wonder, how are we going to do this? How's this going to happen? What if something happens to us? You know, all these kinds of things that run through our minds and stuff. Noah had to deal with those things too. So verse 17, it says, bring out with you every living creature of all flesh, with you all kinds of birds and creeping, everything that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. So again, we talked about what God brought to the ark, the animals, and we again remind you that it did not bring every variation of every species of animal. He had him bring two. The word kind there speaks of what we know as species. So he had him bring two of each species of animal. By the way, he didn't tell Noah, go out and find these things. God brought them to the ark. So I told you last week, which would tell us that when God did that, certainly God would bring the best. If these are going to be the parents of the species that would grow upon the ark, God would certainly bring the best. And he has the ability to do that. So now these different species of animals are leaving the ark. And notice what God's instruction is to the animals. What is it? Be fruitful and multiply. So they were to procreate and reestablish the animal kingdom in the same way that Noah and his wife and his sons and their wife were to procreate and reestablish humanity at that time. Okay, questions or comments? All right, verse 18 says, so Noah went out and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him, every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on the earth, according to their families, went out of the ark. Okay. There's all kinds of little cartoon jokes about this and stuff, like they're heading out and stuff, and this animal is right in front of the lion. The lion's a little bit hungry, and
yeah.
It didn't happen. Okay, can I tell you this? You see, once again, God's hand upon this. First of all, to keep the animals from attacking each other and eating each other, not only on the ark, which you could certainly. Keep them in different places, but once they're leaving the ark, you see that type of thing didn't happen. God protected and preserved the animals until they could replenish upon the earth. Verse 20, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal, of every clean bird, and offered the burnt offerings on the altar. So after the flood, you have the killing of animals, which again goes back to way back when when Noah was instructed of to bring every kind of animal, two of each kind, a male and a female, except for, what did he say? Except for the clean ones. And you're to bring seven of each of those. And why, again, we see one of the answers of why here is we talked about could be for food, but quite likely Noah and his family ate vegetables and stuff upon the ark at the time that they were there, not killing any of the animals. But clearly we have the killing of the animals here for sacrifice after they leave the ark, and a sacrifice of praise to God for God's protection. Verse 21 says, and the Lord smelled a soothing aroma, and the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I destroy every living thing as I have done. So, but here we have the statement that's going to lead into the covenant that God is going to make with Noah. As a matter of fact, it is part of the covenant that God is going to make with Noah. But not just with Noah, but with mankind as a whole. Someone asked me, well, the world can end tomorrow. And I said, no, it can't. Can't end tomorrow. Might end for you tomorrow, not you. Might end for you tomorrow. Okay. But the world won't end tomorrow. At any given time, I can tell you how much time is left in the world. There's 1,007 years left in the world. How do I know? The Bible tells me. At any given time. Antichrist was to come tomorrow. Then you got 7 years, and then you got 1,000 years after that before the Great White Throne. The earth is not going to end tomorrow. That doesn't mean there might not be areas that are devastated, of course. But he even says this. Until it comes to the end of time, he will not allow for the earth to be destroyed again. All right, look at verse 22. It says, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, the cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night, shall not cease. Okay? Everybody got that? Yes, we should be environmentally conscious and do the best thing we can for the world we live in, and keeping it clean and keeping the air clean and keeping, we should do the right things, because we have been made stewards of this earth. So we ought to do the right things by it. But don't fall into that cult that begins to worship the earth and worship these things and make you think that animals are more important than human beings, and a tree is just as legitimate of life before God as you are. I got a little thing that will blow your mind where people are crying, apologizing to the trees because we treated them bad. So no, the earth is not going to be destroyed by global warming. It's not going to be just by a freeze over, although it feels that way today for a lot of people. It's not going to be destroyed. It's just not going to be, unless God can lie. Once again, that does not mean we ought not to take care of the earth that God's given us to be stewards of. But it gets to the inane, how people, think that this is going to, even when a volcano goes off like Mount St. Helens, puts more stuff in the air than you think about all humanity over a long period of time. And the other thing that's good about this, when he talks about this, cold, heat, winter, rain, all these kinds of things. Once again, God has a great filter system in this wonderful ecosystem that he's put. It cleans itself. It cleans itself. It's an amazing thing. God knows how to do this much better than we do. So he reminds us that his hand will be on, his hand of protection on. Again, I would say that if God took his hand off the earth would implode upon itself. But he says he won't. He promises that. And notice here in verse 22, we get the first sense of the seasons that we deal with. And the system of evaporation and rain. And we get the whole picture here in the statement that's made here in this portion right now. Okay. So God has restored this earth in order to in order for we human beings to inhabit it and the animal kingdom to inhabit it. And he has set it up in such a way that there, mankind is not big enough to do what everybody's trying to tell you that they can do. Questions or comments on this chapter?
Question.
Yeah.
You were talking about a cartoon where lions eating some animals in the ark. I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to find it. At what point did animals like that, predators, become carnivores? I mean, because we know before the fall, they were all herbivores, right?
Yes. And I would, you know, again, you have what? After the fall, you have a couple thousand years before the flood comes along. And we know that animals were killed at that time. We know that people were killed at that time. But we don't have, we're about to see some instruction. God did not give them instruction to eat animals till after that. Before that, he told them to eat of every herb of the ground and stuff. So it's a good question. Some of the scientific, the fossils they got clearly shows that animals ate different animals, because some of the fossils have food in the stomach of the, you know, these animals were covered over quickly by just tons and tons of pressure, and they, some of them have not even deteriorated to this day, and they still have food. We talked about some of them have grass or vegetable staying still in their mouth. How do you die that quickly? And how does that not deteriorate? And I told you, if a cow died out here on the ground over here and you left it there for 20 years, let's just say 20 years, it's still not going to fossilize out on the ground out there. And what's going to happen to it? It certainly wouldn't be preserved for thousands of years as a whole, because it would begin to deteriorate. The flesh would come off of it. Any kind of organic material would deteriorate off of it. And maybe you'd see some bones out there. Certainly you'd see some bones. Nobody touched it for 20 years, but that's what you would see. Not fully intact animals that are thousands, that had this happen to them thousands of years ago. All right, so let's go into chapter 9 then. So he says, so God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So the same command that God gave the animal kingdom, now he's given that command to Noah and to his family. He goes on to say in verse 2, and the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth. And isn't it interesting that there's a, what we would call a natural fear of animals, of humanity, until a situation of circumstances basically push them in a corner where they're going to attack back. Animals certainly will attack. But there's a fear of animals. Every animal, James tells us, every animal on the whole face of the earth is able to be tamed. Well, how does that happen? How's that even a possibility, I guess is what I'm saying. Okay. So there is that natural fear, and I would like to put it this way, that God-given fear of animals to human beings. There is an order. God has established an order. Okay. The animals do not set above humans. They're not there to tell you what to do. I'm going to say that again. They're not there to tell you what to do. Okay. That doesn't mean, again, we should treat them harshly. We should abuse them. We should care for them. All those things we should do. But they're not humans. Can I say that again? They're not humans. And certainly a cat is not a human. Okay. So I watch them cats. I just don't trust them. So, all right. So verse 2. And the fear of you and dread you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air and move on the earth, and on the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. So here you see the God-established order. Okay? They're subject to you is what he's saying here. That would mean also, since they are subject to us, if we are proper in our relationship with God and to creation, then once again, we would be proper stewards of these things. So yes, we hunt, but hopefully we hunt with the mind of conservation. We hunt for food, not for sport. I know that's not true of everybody, but that's why we do it. We raise animals for food, not to abuse them, but they are there for food and stuff. And we take care, and we get bossed around by our dogs. Okay.
Watch it.
Okay. anyway, so I'll move on from the dog thing. I got two rat dogs if anybody wants one of them. So, verse 3, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. So here we have the statement that goes beyond what he has said earlier, where he said earlier, every herb will be a food for you. Now we see that the Bible clearly makes it okay for human beings to eat meat. Okay? So when someone tells you, well, humanity was made to be vegetarians, I don't have really a lot of problem with that. That's what happened. But they want to tell you that the Bible says we're supposed to be vegetarians. You take them right here and say, that's not what the Bible says. The Bible tells you right here. God has given permission, and not only permission, instruction that these animals are there for you to consume. Okay? So every moving thing that's on earth will be food for you. I've given you all things, even as the green herbs. Now see what he does here. He refers back to what he said earlier. As I gave you the green herbs prior to this time to eat, now I'm also giving you the animals for you to eat. Questions or comments? Okay. So, by the way, that means it's not unhealthy to eat a steak. I'm telling you, I feel pretty good after eating a steak. I'm just saying. And certainly not unhealthy to eat bacon. I'm still working. I told you, I'm still working on trying to make bacon into manna. But it can't be because they got tired of manna. That can't happen with bacon. So anyway. Yeah.
It mentions Noah and his family. It never tells us how many there were in the family.
Yes, it does. It says that Noah has, and they're going to go into that. Noah has three sons. And they have their three wives. So there are eight people. So we have eight people from which the world will start again from. Say, well, that almost seems impossible. Well, the world started from two people. Okay, now it's going to start from eight people. Now, of course, these people don't live as long as those prior to the flood because, once again, the environment itself has changed. So it's going to take a little bit longer. It did. I mean, you have people living 900 years and procreating for 900 years. You've got a lot of generations in the same household. All right. So he goes on to say, every moving thing that lives on earth shall be food for you. Okay. But then he goes on, verse 4, but you shall not eat flesh with its life. That is its blood. And what he's actually saying here is you're not allowed to drink blood. He's not saying anything about a rare or medium rare steak. Okay. So that stuff is more like what they call that collagen in there rather than just because here we go. When I got my elk not too long ago, you know what they do after I skinned out that elk, after I took out the organs, after I did all those kind of things, they hung that elk for 7 days before they even began to cut it. Okay. There was no blood flowing through that elk in that sense. The veins were gone. All that, the heart was gone. All that was gone and stuff when they carved that elk and stuff like that. So he's not talking about eating rare meat here. He's talking about literally drinking the blood. Or you might even say, you know, completely raw in the sense of just cutting out a hunk of meat and just like an animal would eat something. With the blood in it. You understand the distinction that he's making there. Why? Because God has a very great concern about life. And he actually says it here that life is in the blood. And when we sing songs, as good Baptists sing, we sing there's power in the what? In the blood. When we talk about what Jesus did, he shed his what? His blood, okay, for us. He's literally talking about when he shed his blood, he gave his life. And here you have that interpretation. When it says that Jesus shed his blood, it does not mean that he cut his finger and dripped some blood on the ground. And it doesn't mean that, when I say merely here, I'm not diminishing the pain on the cross. It doesn't merely mean that he was beaten and he was pierced and all those things, but he survived that. That's not what it means about shedding the blood. When the Bible speaks of shedding the blood, it speaks of life. So when we talk about Jesus shed his blood, we're saying Jesus gave his life. He died. The terminology speaks of his death. Which again, the progressives and the liberals want you to believe, theological liberals and progressives want you to believe that no, he didn't actually die. And I've had someone tell me, and the coolness of the tomb revived him from what took on. Well, that would have been a surprise to that Roman soldier who was very adept at killing people, who took his spear and rammed it up in his side and ran it right into his heart. Okay. So again, that's what that speaks of. And here you have the reference. God doesn't put anything in his word that does not have a purpose ultimately to point us to Jesus. So when he talks about the life is in the blood, he's talking about the ultimate sacrifice of Christ. Again, not what you think about this. Did Jesus have divine blood or did he have human blood? Think about it. I'm going to throw it at you. I'll tell you. There's no such thing as divine blood. It is the blood that was in his veins that declared him to be human. Blood is a part of the creation of God. And there are those who almost speak of Jesus' blood as the magic blood, almost the magic blood. God's blood. No, it was human blood. If it wasn't, he wasn't human. Yet he is still God. That's an incredible truth. All right, so we look at this and he talks about, he gives them warning. As they do eat the meat, that eat the meat needs to be properly dealt with. By the way, you might have, and some people would argue this, you might have the first statement concerning that which is kosher. Kosher is a way of preparation of meat, okay, that needs to be properly prepared for consumption. And you have this idea even right here. It doesn't use that term. That's not a term that you'll even find in the Bible, kosher. But what it literally means is the proper preparation of meat for consumption. I don't know how, I guess it's proper preparation of pickles too, because I heard they have some kosher pickles out there too. So anyway, that term kosher just means properly preparing. And for meat, you have the first description here. Meat for consumption must have the blood removed from it, okay? And you are not to drink the blood, but again, that doesn't mean you can't have a rare steak. That's not what he's talking about at all.
When did God tell them not to eat certain?
It's coming up.
Okay.
Yeah. But notice right here, it's very interesting. God tells them at this point, they can eat anything. You notice that? He does not tell them. But for some reason, they knew the difference between clean and unclean because that's described. But we have it in the Mosaic laws where we have the dietary requirements that God gives to the people of Israel. And we won't get to that because that's in Exodus. But they understood the difference between clean and unclean. And I have to believe that part of that would have to be in the dietary thing. If not in the dietary thing, the only reference we have, it's in what can be offered to God as a sacrifice. Okay. But right here, he tells them anything that creeps on the earth is for your food. So and that's an interesting thought too. Now they would certainly have to wait on that cow before there was more cows before they ate that one big bull. So we could have trouble. Okay. We're going to stop there. We're out of time. All right, so we'll start in verse 5. We're in this we'll move. We did move. We did a whole chapter that you can't even believe that. But we will move very quickly in the next two or three weeks. Quite likely before January is over, we will finish through chapter 11 of Genesis. And then, again, I'd like some input on a book that you guys would like to go into after this book of study together. Okay? All right, let's pray together. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for our time together, your word. Thank you for your goodness to us. Now, Lord, as we continue to walk as your people in this earth that you put us in, this earth that you promised that you will, you have not only restored, but Lord, you will keep your hand of protection on it until the end of time. Lord, help us to walk in that kind of faith, knowing that you have all this. And Lord, with all the different scare tactics and all the different things that people are trying to put out that are contrary to what your word says, help us to remain biblical people who walk and live in faith. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, online. We will see you all later.
Thank you, Tony.
You bet. God bless.
God bless you.